This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Gunslinging cowboy on a mission of revenge stands toe-to-toe with the man he's been riding after since the opening credits. That's right. It's been 87 minutes, and now it comes down to this. And he looks that bushwhacking buzzard straight in the eye and he says, "Draw. Go ahead. Skin that smoke wagon and see what happens." A long pause. And then shots ring out, and the guy who got the biggest paycheck, including like 20% of the gross, rides off into the setting sun as it casts long shadows over the rugged desert landscape. And that, my friends, is the American Western.
That's the best I can do.
I could listen to that for a whole hour.
It's public radio.
Westerns,
that's what we're going to talk about today on Movies on the Radio. Quite an evolution since the good versus evil cowboys and Indian days when the Western got its start. Here with me to talk about listener picks and their favorites are Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Laura Boys, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Frank.
And Marcia
Howdy,
Gordon.
I should say. Howdy.
Oh, howdy.
Howdy, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, film processor at... says professor at North Carolina State University. Hi, Marcia.
Howdy back.
Howdy back to you. The Western, wow. And, you know, obviously, we've just sci-fi. We've picked a lot of genres that have many, many, many forms. But, man, the Western is kind of the oldest form with the most variations.
Well, like sci-fi, the Western really has its roots kind of coinciding with the birth of American narrative cinema. There's a film called The Great Train Robbery that you can find on the YouTube or wherever that Thomas Edison Company did in 1903, which is a train robbery with the good guys coming and shooting the bad guys. And it's, you know, it's kind of the genesis of a story that gets told over and over again in lots of different forms.
And the Western is really America's creation myth, which is why we have to revisit it in each of our time frames and kind of recast it with a contemporary bent.
Yeah, no coincidence that you mentioned Edison and, of course, the turn of the 20th century, the moment when that myth has to be made, the West is dead. And we've done our damage to the continent, and now we've got to make up a cover story for why it was actually virtuous to do what we did to the native populations and the environment. So we did. And
yeah,
it became the Western.
Absolutely. I mean, so many Western stories, especially from 30s, 40s, and 50s, when the genre was in its kind of evolutionary and heyday in terms of mainstream American narrative cinema, are about frontier towns and the settlement of them, the defending of them. And often, you know, you get these very stereotypical Indians, they're not Native Americans. They have no depth as individuals. They're Sioux, Comanche, whatever, and they're there to terrorize. And, you know, that's one of the things you kind of have to overlook if you're if you are interested in cultural sensitivity. Right. Westerns have a lot of really offensive images of Native Americans. Women.
Women don't do well in the early
no,
Westerns.
No, Westerns are a problem to me because they're too racist, they're too rapey. And every problem is settled with a gun, which, you know, has its reverberations right up into the present day.
Yeah, women's place on the frontier is almost always as a prostitute, or occasionally there's interesting women who have power, like in a film like Johnny Guitar with Joan Crawford or something like that. But
not let out the chuckling banditos and all of the racist characteristics of... you know, Mexican people as well.
And in that way, in an unintended way, that's how it is true to the founding of the American.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's a white male privilege foundation, so you shouldn't
expect
Westerns
are a white male privilege fantasy, so let's just state that right at the beginning.
And a whitewash. It's about the virtues of bravery and all of those things, which, you know, doesn't really take to wipe out a race of people.
Exactly. And in the teens and 20s, they were really being made for theaters to appeal to young boys. I mean, these were not prestigious films. They were cheap B films on the bottom half of a double bill. And it really took until a later period for them to become, you know, serious films.
Of course, in the early days, people who had lived through the Old West actually were making silent films.
Right.
Wyatt Earp himself lived until 1929 and hung around on silent movie sets and tried to get his version of what the real Old West was like, which in fact no one was interested in.
No, well, let's talk about the Old West as it was reflected in the early days of Hollywood. Marcia, your pick takes us back to 1939. Tell us about it.
So my pick is Stagecoach, which is one of the great generative Westerns of all time. This is John Ford. It's his first sound Western, and it's considered by many people to be the first like grown-up Western, so taking it out of the realm of bottom half of the double bill for boys' films. And it's the basic plot of strangers on a stagecoach in Apache territory, and it has this ensemble cast, but it's really about the individuals and their histories, and this is John Wayne's key Western role that sends him off on the rest of his career.
You're the notorious Ringo Kid.
My friends just call me Ringo. Nickname I had as a kid. Right name's Henry.
Seems to me I knew your family, Henry. Didn't I fix your arm once when you bucked off a horse?
Are you Doc Boone?
I certainly am. Now, let's see. I'd just been honorably discharged from the Union Army after the War of the Rebellion.
You mean the war for the Southern Confederacy, sir?
I mean nothing of the kind, sir.
That was my kid brother broke his arm. You did a good job, Doc, even if you was drunk.
Thank you, son. Professional compliments are always pleasing.
Yes, they are.
What happened to that boy whose arm I fixed?
He was murdered.
Here we go. It's on. Stagecoach,
yeah, exactly. Right? And so this is really a film about people's pasts and how they're reconciling with them and how they're trying to escape from them and they can't. And it has all these great character actors in it. And it was shot in Monument Valley, which became the kind of the American imagination for what the West looked like, thanks largely to John Ford.
And for many years, other directors wouldn't even go into Monument Valley because it was looked on as Ford's territory.
Yeah.
So it's very closely associated with his films.
Well, let's continue with the classics now, and we'll talk. We have a listener pick that this listener has chosen, High Noon.
This is Nell Steelman Whitlock in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I would like to nominate High Noon. I saw it when I was a little girl, and of course I had no idea that it had any more depth than the classic Western themes. The strong, silent Western hero in Gary Cooper, in contrasting with his radiantly beautiful wife in Grace Kelly, and that in stark black and white. The theme of it was amplified by the beautiful music that was very powerful and haunting, the Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling song. The images kept coming back to me the more I thought about this film, like the tension of the pounding, the oncoming train, the clock pendulum swinging back and forth and just building to a dramatic climax.
All right, Chief, come on out. Come out of your friend here and get it the way Pierce did.
I'll come out. Let her go.
As soon as you walk through that door. Come on, I'll hold my fire.
Everything came out all right, and it was very reassuring to the little girl.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Although you're grieving, I can't be leaving until I shoot Frank Miller dead.
There you go, High Noon from 1952.
Well, we're starting right away with things that are reflecting contemporary culture, because this was a metaphor for standing up against the House on Un-American Activities Committee. So it was the lone sheriff showing right against all of the people who were too cowardly to stand up to the bullies.
I'm thinking we're going to have some Westerns in the next couple of years. Let me put it to you that
way. Yeah, no, it's exactly, well, here we are again.
Here
right?
we are again. So we need Westerns now. And this film is so important. It is art. This is the Western as art. And those images that the listener was referring to of the clock and time, this is a film that takes place almost as if it were in real time. This is one of those mythic Westerns. And it was very important because it really triggered a spate of adult Westerns in the 1950s, including films like Shane,
which I'm going to be showing this Friday at the North Carolina Museum of Art. And Shane was also interesting because it was a metaphor for the GIs returning from World War II who found themselves unable to assimilate back into civilization. So here are the lone gunmen, you know, mysterious, out of the past, unable to figure out where he's to go now that his fighting days are supposedly over.
It's interesting that by the late 40s and early 50s, the Western is so well established as a trope and a type that it can now be manipulated and used in so many different forms to tell so many different kinds of stories, including allegory.
Absolutely. I mean, I think of all film genres, in some ways, the Western becomes the most allegorical. And it's because I think you can tell these mythic stories about frontier, about good and bad. I mean, these dichotomies are fairly clear until they become really ruffled in the 60s and you get these ambiguous Western heroes. And so I think it's important as a way to tell stories about bullying and power and things that have, unfortunately, pertinence to our national
character. Well, good and bad and the ambiguity there. And also a story about freedom that becomes essential to the American story and how that is viewed very differently over time. We'll talk more about that today on Movies on the Radio. We're looking at Westerns, your picks, and also Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the Radio today, this month, talking about gunslingers and saloons, bringing you top picks from Westerns. And with me, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Marcia, film professor at NC State. Laura's a film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. And we're talking about roles. And, of course, in the old days when movies, you know, they first began, a lot of white men, mostly killing people who were not white, things did begin to change. Women's roles changed slightly. And here's at least one example of that in 1965.
Hi, my name is Brennan Ames Ferris. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, and my pick for Best Western is Cat Ballou, starring Jane Fonda. It's my favorite Western because it's a comedy, but it also has a very strong female character, and strong female characters are something that we don't have enough of these days, and certainly didn't have enough of back when this movie was produced originally.
You all say you love me and are beholden to me, and take it easy, Cat. We're gonna take care of you. And the first time I ask you to do one little thing for me, like rob one little train.
Another reason I grew to like the movie more as I got older was when I learned that Jane Fonda had been an anti-war activist in the 60s, which obviously doesn't relate to doing a Western movie, but does relate, you know, to being a strong female.
You won't make me cry. You'll never make me cry.
1965 film, Cat Ballou. Laura.
Yes, I just watched this a couple of days ago again because it was always a favorite of mine as well. And Cat Ballou starts out as one of the, you know, cliches of the Western, you know, on her way to the frontier to be a school marm. But after her father is murdered by a gunslinger, she asks all the men around her to help her get justice. And they can't do it. So she decides to take the law into her own hands. And it's a great transformation of a character, and it also has a very funny performance by Lee Marvin, who won an Oscar.
Yeah, so Lee Marvin won the Best Actor for, and this is a wacky film, and it's a wacky role. He was up against Rod Steiger in The Pawnbroker, Laurence Olivier in Othello, and Richard Burton in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. So this is kind of an astonishing win in that way.
Well, it is, because he plays a sort of a slapstick drunk gunslinger.
Yeah, he does, right? But he is one of the scariest villains in the history of movies. Anyone who's seen him throw a pot of boiling hot coffee into Gloria Graham's face in the Big Heat would never see him as a comical drunk.
Yeah.
My favorite moment in the movie, by the way, is when he and his horse are a staggered, leaning against the side of a barn.
And in
they both look drunk, and they're both actually leaning on the barn.
And in fact, when he collected his Oscar, he thanked the horse for helping to win an Oscar.
Okay, Cat Ballou, Laura, your pick now.
Also is another Lee Marvin film, because I was not only just a big Lee Marvin fan, but at that point, if you can believe it, he was the number one movie star in the entire world. And
for you or the entire world?
For me, yes. But also as far as the box office because of The Dirty Dozen, because of Cat Ballou, because of The Professionals and some other movies. And The Professionals I like because it's basically a 60s caper movie that is transposed to the Old West. And what's interesting about it, it's a little bit racist because the Mexicans are played by Jack Palance and Claudia Cardinale, but they are three-dimensional characters, and the heroes of the film actually fought with Pancho Villa during the Mexican Revolution, so they're very sympathetic to all of the Mexican characters, and their caper takes a turn because of politics.
The Professionals.
That's a lot of women there. Beautiful, classy. Guts. Hard enough to kill you and soft enough to change you. Reminds me of another Maria. Yours.
Amigo. Don't con me. She's going back. If I have to do it alone, she's going back.
It's just what I wanted to hear you say.
So what else is on your mind besides 100-proof women, 90-proof whiskey, and 14-carat gold?
Amigo. You just wrote my epitaph.
As a clip from the 1966 film The Professionals. A couple of things I noticed. Number one, it's a caper flick. It's got that 40s noir patter kind of cadence.
It absolutely does. It has very, very clever dialogue. It also has Woody Strode in it, who was the go-to African-American guy for all of these Westerns.
And that was Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster, yes, who at 53 still did all of his own stunts. It's really pretty astonishing.
A lot of these ensemble cast Westerns have these great, like, kind of all-star casts of either the best character actors or the best stars. It's kind of like Grand Hotel.
Right.
Stick it in the desert.
Because this has Robert Ryan and Ralph Bellamy, and, I mean, it's really
it's part of why it was so fun to see these films, because the actors got to do really different things than they did in, say, like, contemporary films.
Although I do feel sorry when they take these elderly actors out on these tough locations, and it's like, I hope they made sure they got enough water so they didn't have a heart attack.
Laura's concern for the aging actor.
Not to mention the horses.
Not to mention the horses.
We can't even talk about the horses.
Our next pick, and now we talk about a turn, because again, it as we said, it didn't take long, the 40s and 50s, before we started turning the themes in Westerns, and now we see another turn, and this, of course, spaghetti Westerns, where Westerns take a big turn, the good, the bad, and the ugly being perhaps the best example.
Hello, this is Locke Milholland from Raleigh, North Carolina. My pick for my favorite Western is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, starring Clint Eastwood, Lee Van Cleef, and the ugly, whose name I can't remember. It's my favorite movie because it takes a flip on the genre, where instead of having the good guy in the white hat and the bad guy in the black hat, you have the recognition of a third option, which is that there can be an anti-hero, an anti-villain, and the ugly, as represented in the title even, where it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And ultimately, they go into another flip on the genre, and instead of having the high noon shootout where it's fair to both sides, they have a three-way shootout where each of the parties has done things to the other to gain an edge on the shootout.
Oh! You pig! You wanted to get me killed! When'd you unload it?
Last night. You see, in this world, there's two kinds of people, my friend. Those with loaded guns, and those who dig.
Yep, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, spaghetti Westerns, and that really does mark a turn in Westerns.
Yeah, I mean, Sergio Leone, I could not love these films any more than I do. I mean, the idea of this Italian director coming in, getting American actors, bringing them to Spain to shoot these films and to kind of outdo American kind of versions of the mythic West in terms of violence, in terms of the classic revenge plot, I mean, which these films are over and over again, as many Westerns are, to stylize it in such a wonderful way with that totally memorable Morricone music that he uses throughout. I mean, these are some of the best films in the genre.
And it's worth noting that these clips as we go on are very Clint Eastwood heavy, that Clint Eastwood's persona as a defender of justice seems to be pretty influential through the second half of the 20th
century. But not just
a
defender of justice, because as the caller points out, he's not always exactly on the side of justice. He's one of those figures that's like in this kind of morally questionable zone.
Well, no, maybe that's what makes him so contemporary.
It does, and that's what I think Leone does in these films. He takes the Western where good and bad, good and evil were white hats and bad hats,
right,
and black hats, and good triumphed. And there was no good, not a second of good. And I mean, these are bounty hunters. You know, they're taking other people's. And there's moments of virtue where someone who is weak might be, you know, rescued from the mess,
but
I think
incidental.
It's kind of incidental. It just sets up a comic moment.
It's not the point of the quest.
Right.
Also, for me, this is a tiny point, but I love the Foley in these films. The gunshots, all of it sounded so great in those
clearly from
long
that opening.
Because they probably couldn't afford sync sound, so it was all done in post.
It was
all
done in post.
There was a lot of all the dubbing of the foreign actors.
Yeah, the dubbing was awful, but the
it's great.
But the way the gunshot sounded and all the rest of it, great stuff. And not to mention the cinematography and the direction, these long shots, these, you know, lots of close-ups, which really characterize these well, and the film. So we have other types of Westerns, as you can imagine. Let's go to another listener pick.
My name is Brad Campbell, and I'm from Fairview, North Carolina. And my top pick for Westerns is the movie Hombre. This was a movie that I just kind of accidentally stumbled upon. I watched it and was just kind of blown away. The language wasn't cliched. The performances were really strong. The story was compelling, and there seemed to be something kind of going on beneath the surface as well. And then the performances, they were just really incredible. They included Richard Boone as the ultimate villain.
My mama taught me to remove my hat and my cigar in the presence of a lady. Whatever else I take off depends on how lucky I get.
And Frederick March is this really unscrupulous judge, and Barbara Rush just in an amazing performance as a kind of a down-on-her-luck widow. And I think 50 years later, this movie's social commentary and themes are still relevant today.
You can be white, Mexican, or Indian, but I think it pays you to be a white man for a while. Put yourself on the winning side for a change.
Is that where you are?
Well, a Mexican is closer to it than a white mountain Apache, I can tell you that.
And then kind of above all of that is this really wonderful performance by Paul Newman, who's this white man raised by Indians who re-enters so-called civilized society, only to discover who the real savages are.
There we go, the 1967 film Hombre. What do we know about that?
Right. Well, Paul Newman played this sort of ethnically ambiguous character with his piercing blue eyes, which spoke to sort of a fluidity, you know, taking what side was advantageous at any particular moment. Although you also heard there Martin Balsam is a Mexican, not very convincing.
It was the 60s,
right. He was raised by Apaches,
right?
Right,
raised by Apaches. But as I recall, his actual ethnicity was also kind of ambiguous.
But this, I mean, I would say two things. One is that's a story that there's been a fascination with throughout the history of the genre, which is the idea of a white person being raised in captivity of Native Americans. You get this in The Searchers. You get this over and over again. Usually it ties into some kind of big ethical quandary having to do with the character in this case.
Because you have to choose sides.
You have to choose sides. So the other thing is that this is a period of revisionist Westerns where filmmakers are looking at the genre and all of the conventions and going, okay, wait a second. So this is how we've treated race. This is how we've treated gender. Let's start questioning and taking these things apart the way the culture was in the 60s and 70s.
And by that time, of course, people had begun to notice that one shot would kill 9 Indians. And that became a sort of a topic. And so, as you say, there's a focus now on how have we been representing these people in
and,
our films.
Yeah, troubling that. Yeah. Representation.
So let's go to another listener pick as we look at Westerns today on Movies on the Radio.
Hi, I'm Neil Morris from Fuquay Varina and a film critic for Indie Week. My choice for my favorite Western is Once Upon a Time in the West by director Sergio Leone. Everyone's familiar with Leone's work in The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. But to me, Once Upon a Time in the West, both visually and thematically, is a much more mature, thoughtful piece of work. All of Leone's visual flourishes is there, as is the tri-headed protagonist, here comprising Charles Bronson, Jason Robards, and Henry Fonda in one of the of cinema's greatest playing against types. Although the film borrows liberally from American Westerns that preceded it, and in that way is an homage to the Western genre, its narrative is very much about the end of the West. The railroad, which figures prominently in the film, and is seen as sort of the culmination of Western expansion and other films, is seen as a vessel bringing the end of the West in both technology and capitalism.
The railroad. The boom towns. A new life. And the promised land. Once upon a time.
So in that way, although Once Upon a Time in the West celebrates the Western film genre, it is also about the end of not just the nostalgia of the West, but in many ways that genre as well.
We're talking about Once Upon a Time in the West, part of our Western theme today on The State of Things. And that, this is a film that I didn't know that he made. I knew about the dollars.
Such a good one. And Fonda is so incredible. Yeah. And he must have taken such pleasure in getting to play this character after being good for so many years. But, I mean, the railroad story, there are a lot of Westerns about the railroad. One of my favorites is McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which has not been talked about yet, a Robert Altman film, which I know a lot of callers called in about. But that idea of there has to be an end, right? Yeah. I mean, the idea of Western expansion and then the railroad is being like a kind of perfect symbol of getting as far as you can go. And then there's the end of the line. And I like the way that the listener talked about that in relationship
to
this film.
Wilderness versus civilization is one of the big themes of the Western, and the railroad just cuts a swath right through the middle of that.
Yeah, one of the themes we hadn't talked about much is this theme of freedom and what that meant. The
right.
Wide open spaces, a place where you could run away from civilization and be yourself, whatever that meant, right?
There's this beautiful shot at the beginning of The Searchers, John Ford's 1950, another one of his masterpiece Westerns, of the woman of the household opening the door to the frontier, and this shot through the door of the darkened interior and this kind of expanse on the outside, out of that comes John Wayne's character. So that tension between creating something domestic and closed versus the freedom that comes with, you know, roaming the range in this romantic and troubling way often.
But of course, the woman was trapped in that sod house, doing all of the chores, and it was the man who got to go out and ride the range.
Well, let's talk. By 1969, everybody was having fun with the stereotype and the form that is the Western.
My name is Kendall Lau. I'm from Durham, North Carolina. My pick for the best Western movie is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. The reason that I chose this movie is because I absolutely love the setting, particularly when they go to South America. And there's one scene in that movie where I think it's the final shootout scene, and just the energy and of that scene, the kind of paranoia of that scene. It's a really interesting perspective for what otherwise is often a kind of romanticized adventure story of criminals kind of escaping to another foreign country.
I figured secretly you wanted to know, so I told you. Australia.
Australia's no better than here.
Oh, that's all you know.
They mean one thing.
They speak English in Australia.
They do?
That's right, smart guys, so we wouldn't be foreigners.
When we get outside, when we get to the horses, just remember one thing. Hey, wait a minute.
What?
You didn't see the fours out there, did you?
The fours?
No.
Oh, good.
For a moment there, I thought we were in trouble.
Spoiler alert. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
Kid. A lot of heavy breathing in that
1969.
Clip.
1969.
But up until then, it's really very funny and loosey-goosey and sort of improvised in that 60s kind of way.
And this was Paul Newman and Robert Redford a few years before The Sting, right? Which would cement their kind of uber-powerful star-teaming capabilities. This was a huge hit. A lot of these films are incredibly popular. And that's, I think, key to the genre is that this, like sci-fi, I mean, these are films that can really reach a mass audience, which to me makes it all the more interesting when they can also infuse the film with some kind of political discourse. In this case, I don't think that's necessarily the case.
No, but
because it's about the end of the frontier and where does the rebel go when there's nowhere left to rebel? And that is a totally 60s theme.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it comes up a couple of times. I mean, not only that scene itself, but you know, standing on the cliff, right? I mean, that's it. The edge of the water, the fall will kill you, you know, that sort of thing. We are talking about Westerns today on Movies on the Radio, and I'm doing that with Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon, and we will return with more in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Movies on the Radio today with Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon. Marcia, film professor at NC State. Laura, the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, where they will be showing Shane on Friday. And here's another listener pick. We're talking about favorite Westerns, and here's another one.
This is Joe Nash of Raleigh, and my pick for Best Western is The Outlaw Josie Wales. I think this is equally a Western, a war movie, and kind of a Greek classical epic tale in the vein of the Odyssey. From the start, Josie is escaping a long war, and even an opening scene where his troop has been tricked by the North and is gunned down by a Gatling gun from the back of a wagon is very much in the sense of a Trojan horse. And then he flees, and along the way, as he flees to try to find a new home or just to escape, he's met with resistance and obstacles along the way where he has to either overcome these life and death situations or make certain choices which road to take and which one not to.
So you'll be Josie Wales.
How might you know that, Granny?
Soldiers were here looking for you about 2 hours ago. They say you killed your own men.
You lying blue scumbellies.
They say you're a hard-put and desperate man, Josie Wales. You know what I say?
What's that?
I say that big talk's worth doodly squat. Now, them poultices, they're laced with feather moss and mustard root.
It's obliged, Granny.
You can pay me when you see me again, Josie Wales.
I reckon so.
In the end, he does find his way home, and it's a new home. You know, it's not exactly Odysseus returning to his kingdom, but it kind of resolves that epic loop.
Is he Joe Nash talking about The Outlaw Josie Wales?
Yeah, this was a film directed by and starring Clint Eastwood, kind of in the front end of his directorial career. And it is just a great revenge quest film. The way the listener was talking about it is perfect in terms of that hybridity between war and peace and Western.
And the Civil War is a shadow that hangs over a lot of Westerns.
And according to IMDb, the first time in the history of Westerns that the phrase doodly squat was used in a Western.
Thank you, IMDb and Frank, for that.
So we talk about stereotype tropes, and here's one that just breaks them all. This is a film that deals with a Polish rabbi on a mission.
Hi, I'm Donna Clee Williams from up here in Balsam, a little bit west of Asheville. And my nominee for the single most unknown, unappreciated, underrated Western comedy is Robert Aldrich's 1979 The Frisco Kid. This movie is probably a forerunner of the Shanghai Kid. It's another one in which somebody from a totally different culture gets thrown into the survival challenges of the classic Old West. But in this one, the sort of innocent abroad is a Polish rabbi who's struggling to get across the West to take up a position in a synagogue in San Francisco.
What the hell are you doing?
I don't ride today.
What are you talking about?
Today is Saturday.
So?
I don't ride on Saturday.
Well, I know that, but don't tell me you ain't gonna ride today.
I ain't gonna ride today.
I asked you not to tell me that.
That's what I'm telling you.
But this ain't no ordinary Saturday.
Why is this Saturday different from all other Saturdays?
Because this Saturday, there's a hanging posse chasing us. I promise you, right now, they're doubling back to that stream.
I don't ride on Saturday.
Jesus, you give me the pea doodles.
And this is a movie that was so funny that I actually watched it the first time in a theater and then just stayed to watch it again.
Frisco Kid.
Well, I watched this not that long ago when I was revisiting a lot of Gene Wilder after he died. It's got Harrison Ford in his most adorable sort of Han Solo phase.
But he wasn't good.
He wasn't necessarily good, and I
in
have to
film.
Say
okay.
that this is the greatest idea ever for a movie, but the movie itself, the pacing now seems a little bit slow to
ripe
modern
for
taste.
A remake.
And I think this would be great because of there are many untold stories of the Old West and the Jewish people who came and opened stores in all of these towns out west. This is a story that has really not been told.
Let me also add, there's a big tradition of Western literature and filmmaking in Central and Eastern Europe, in Germany, in Czech
it's
Republic,
insane.
In Austria.
Yes.
And these are by people who had never been to America. And so it's wonderful. If you get a chance to see these films and read these books, it is totally fascinating.
Let's move on to another one. We'll take us now, launch our program into the 1990s with the film Unforgiven.
My name is Seth Hoffman. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my favorite Western is Unforgiven by Clint Eastwood. I'd say it's my favorite movie, not only because the great acting up and down with Morgan Freeman, Clint Eastwood, Gene Hackman, a beautifully filmed movie too, but also I think taking the next step in a moral lesson wrapped up in a certain degree of moral ambiguity in terms of who is good and who is bad, and do your choices define who you are as a person?
I was the first one.
First one what?
First one I ever killed.
Well, you sure killed the hell out of that fella today.
It don't seem real. I ain't gonna never breathe again, ever. How he's dead? All on account of pulling a trigger. Well, I guess they had it coming.
We all have it coming, Fred.
1992 film Unforgiven, directed by and starring Clint Eastwood.
And this was, if I'm not mistaken, I think this was an Oscar sweep film. I mean, everyone saw this film. Every now and then a Western kind of taps into the zeitgeist, and this is one of them. And I think this is the last time we'll be talking about Clint Eastwood today, but by the number of times we've talked about him, it's such an indication that there are certain stars that are so tied into genre and have such influence. I mean, obviously Eastwood and then Wayne before him.
Right. I was just going to say he's the John Wayne of, you know, the second half of the Western epoch.
He seemed to evolve in a way that maybe John Wayne didn't, don't you think, in terms of the themes that he was able to take on, the kind of Westerns?
Well, he had a creative control that John Wayne never had, and an interest in creative control.
Yeah, and I think his Italian phase greatly influenced him in terms of complicating his relationship to the genre, and then, coming back and directing those
films.
I mean,
he was able to play against the type that got him. He certainly wasn't Rawhide by the time he's doing a film like Unforgiven. He even drops the affected drawl, right? I mean, he's talking like Clint Eastwood now, and not like some hombre. Unforgiven, by the way, won 4 Oscars. Let's move on. Again, we're talking about films, and women have never been terribly well represented in the Western, but there are some exceptions. Let's listen.
My name is Kuaila Dea. I am calling from Durham, North Carolina, and the Western I've picked is Bad Girls. Bad Girls makes my pick for a great Western because it's a woman-centric Western, and we don't see many of those, with the exception of maybe this film, The Quick and the Dead, with Sharon Stone. But this cast had 4 beautiful, wonderful women, Drew Barrymore, Madeline Stowe, Annie McDowell, Mary Stuart Masterson, who were taking control of their own lives.
It's a homesteader's claim to 640 acres. I'd like it if you all go in with me.
All they wanted was a fresh start.
Well, your claim's worthless without your husband alive.
They had no rights.
You touch her again, you're a dead man.
I don't let my friends get hung.
They had no justice.
If your laws don't include me, well, then they just don't apply to me either.
And no one to stand up for them.
A woman like you would be happier shopping someplace else.
For me, it was a good film because it showed me that women could also be tough, and that women, and to show that there was presence of women in the West that weren't just women who were working in saloons or women who were working in houses of disrepute.
I watched the same trailer that the clips were from, and my immediate reaction was, why are they bad girls? They're doing all the things that men do. Men are heroes and women are bad when they do the same thing.
Well, I would just refer people who are interested in women in interesting roles in Westerns to look at Sam Fuller's 40 Guns with Barbara Stanwyck, to look at Nick Rae's Johnny Guitar with Joan Crawford, and more recently Kelly Reichardt's Meek's Cut Off with Michelle Williams, which are all really interesting iterations.
And this preview also reproduces a particular shot from Cat Balloon, an earlier movie that had a woman in the central role.
I had the sense that Bad Girls was in quotes, the way those Western men may have seen those women as bad girls who were quite clearly only working for what they deserve.
I think it's the marketing department who made them have that skinny dipping scene.
The Western breaks its own genre and finds its way into sci-fi. Let's listen.
My name is Chris Monroe. I'm from Fuquay's Arena, and my pick is Serenity. And the reason I chose it is I'm a huge fan of Firefly and Joss Whedon's stuff in general for the characters and for the writing. But I felt Serenity, you know, looked great. And it has this Western thing where it feels like there's a space where people can go and try to live sort of outside of, you know, maybe a government structure that, you know, doesn't really feel right to them, and try to make things better. So it's kind of a hopeful escapism.
You know what the first rule of flying is? Well, I suppose you do, since you already know I'm about to say.
I do. But I like to hear you say it.
Love. You can learn all the math in the verse. You take a boat in the air that you don't love, she'll shake you up just as sure as a turn in the world. Love keeps her in the air when she ought to fall down. Tells you she's hurting before she keens. Makes her home.
Storm's getting worse.
We'll pass through it soon enough.
Serenity from 2005.
Well, space is, as they say, the final frontier. And there's also a long tradition with this. Star Wars is a very overtly version of John Ford's The Searchers, that idea that that's the place that we have to go to and to colonize next. And it raises all the same issues as the West did.
Yeah, it's a very elastic genre.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Race is the one topic that we really haven't taken on directly in the Western genre, and it finally was in Django Unchained.
You kill people, and they give you a reward?
Certain people, yeah.
Bad people?
Ah, badder they are, bigger the reward. Which brings me to you. And I must admit, I'm at a bit of a quandary when it comes to you. On one hand, I despise slavery. On the other hand, I need your help. If you're not in a position to refuse, all the better.
Clip from the 2012 film Django Unchained by Quentin Tarantino.
So Tarantino, of course, what he does is he disturbs genres, and he has a lot of fun taking them apart. And so he kind of looks to the spaghetti westerns, which are already revisions of the American Western, and then he takes it a step further by dealing with slavery in the course of it. I would also point listeners to it was Mario Van Peebles' Posse, which is a film about black cowboys. And so Tarantino is not the first person to enter into this, but he's the first to do it, of course, in the Tarantino way.
Okay, well, we're talking about other untold Western stories. Certainly the African-American stories in the Old West are part of that. I learned from my favorite...
Chinese immigrants, too. Played a huge role in the
I Romans. Learned from my favorite silly TV show, Timeless, that the character that the Lone Ranger was based on was a black man. I looked it up. I could not believe it. It's like, why has no one wanted to tell that story?
Well, let's move on a little bit, and we don't have an answer for that. We can put it out. Our research team will be back. But in the meantime, let's listen to this clip.
Hey, my name is Ben Richter. I'm from Durham, North Carolina. And my pick for my favorite Western is just from last year. It's called Hell or High Water. I chose this one not necessarily because I think it's the greatest of all the Westerns, but I do think it's currently maybe the most interesting in terms of the political climate right now and the role that the Westerns can potentially play in cinema. So Hell or High Water is set in the contemporary West. The backdrop, you know, is Texas. So there's a lot of the familiar characters of the West. And you can see in small, subtle ways that, you know, after the housing crisis and after the recession, there's not necessarily work for everyone. So the film starts with basically these brothers who are tasked with having to pay off the bank for back taxes that their mom owed just before she died. And so you're kind of brought in on the side of the supposed bad guys. And over the course of this film, you see a lot of the side characters who are witnessing some of these bank robbers. Even one of the police officers recognizes that the bank is the real bad guy.
You know, the bank
loan, just enough to keep your mama poor. Thought they could swipe her land.
Now they can foreclose on Friday.
So come hell or high water, get the money to the bank on Thursday.
And then you are free and clear.
Little brother, go get that money.
Good morning, folks. Open the drawers.
You got a gun on you, old man?
You damn right I got a gun on me. Y'all gonna steal my gun, too?
We ain't stealing from you, we're stealing from the bank.
That's a film from last year, Hell or High Water.
Yeah, so, I mean, Laura pointed out earlier, Westerns are very flexible, and this is certainly the case. This is kind of Bonnie and Clyde meets the Western. It's like reverse mortgages and banks instead of cowboys and Indians, and it's I thought it was a really fantastic film that used the genre for the moment, and I thought Jeff Bridges was awesome as the sheriff.
The thing that's so fascinating about the Westerns is the villains change over the years. And now nobody hates anybody more than they do, you know, the banks and Wall Street that stole the money from. I mean, they could have come up to you with a gun, but instead they just erased your balance, you know, right, from the ether.
I mean, that's been the question all the way through. It's like, who writes the laws and who's the bad guy? And if the law is written for you to steal legally, well, then you call the bank. Otherwise, you got to get a mask and watch out for the law.
Note the swamp.
Hey, we got to go now, but we're coming back next month and we're going to talk about dystopian films. Perfect.
Imagine that.
Because this is exactly the era to talk about the dystopia, which we have just entered. And we may or may not get out, but we're going to have fun doing it with my guests on Movies on the Radio, Laura Boys, Marsha Gordon. Laura's going to be showing Shane at the Museum of...
Friday at 8 o'clock.
All right, and you can find out all that stuff, including and links to the movies that we've talked about at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC News Director, and North Carolina Public Radio's broadcast service, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.